finding pregnancy support you can trust is worth celebrating. Getting it on sale is worth belting Beyonce in your car. That's right. Ritual's Black Friday sale is on. Support your body's new nutrient needs with their clinically backed prenatal multivitamin. Or give back to your gut with Natal Biotic, a probiotic supplement for trying, pregnancy, and postpartum to support digestive, vaginal, and baby's immune health. At Ritual, quality is top priority. All of their supplements are clean, third-party tested for heavy metals, and 100% made traceable. Because you deserve high-quality support at every stage of your pregnancy journey. Cut prices without cutting corners and get their best savings on their best supplements with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pregnancy support. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. You won't find a better deal on science-backed pregnancy supplements than at Ritual's Black Friday sale. Get what you really deserve, like a prenatal you can trust. Made with bioavailable key nutrients, it even earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. Save 40% on your first month at ritual.com/pregnancy support. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Finding pregnancy support you can trust is worth celebrating. Getting it on sale is worth belting Beyonce in your car. That's right. Ritual's Black Friday sale is on. Support your body's new nutrient needs with their clinically backed prenatal multivitamin. Or give back to your gut with Natal Biotic, a probiotic supplement for trying, pregnancy, and postpartum to support digestive, vaginal, and baby's immune health. At Ritual, quality is top priority. All of their supplements are clean, third-party tested for heavy metals, and 100% made traceable. Because you deserve high-quality support at every stage of your pregnancy journey. Cut prices without cutting corners and get their best savings on their best supplements with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pregnancy support. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by Reality Winner. In May 2017, whilst working for a US defense contractor, Reality Winner leaked a classified NSA report to The Intercept. It revealed how Russian military intelligence had attempted to breach America's voting infrastructure in the days before the 2016 election. Reality discusses with me, in her own words, her thoughts and feelings around her leaking classified information, then being arrested, convicted, serving jail time, and now how she's attempted to rebuild her life. Some listeners may not agree with what she did and what she has to say, but personally I think this is a very interesting interview, and I felt I got a real sense of who she is and where she was coming from. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Reality, welcome to Secrets and Spies. Great to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. So for the benefit of listeners who may know of your name from the headlines, how would you describe who you are today beyond the infamous NSA leaker?
Honestly, I'm just the typical American. I have a criminal record, so I know what millions, I think it's 9 million other Americans are going through as far as trying to find jobs in this, you know, this fractious economy that we have right now. But I don't identify as that. I'm just Coach Ree, and I'm kind of known as that person who will pick up any animal that they find and try to rescue it.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. Well, thank you again for joining me today. So obviously we're going to be chatting a bit about sort of your experiences, and you know, I hope obviously this conversation doesn't sort of cause you any distress, because that's not my intention, but I just want to sort of get your story as much as we can out there. So before everything that happened in 2017, you had sort of built a serious career in intelligence. You were fluent in multiple languages, serving as a linguist in the Air Force. Can you take us back to sort of that journey about what drew you into military service and then later the NSA?
Yeah, so there's many of us millennials in our 30s that were greatly impacted by 9/11. And I mean, obviously hindsight is 2020. There was a lot of propaganda around the event. But for us, that was kind of like the first time that we saw a very dangerous world. And from that day forth, I just started looking at the world as sort of something to be fixed. My father was a psychologist and a theologist. And so he had always wanted to kind of decode where faith and faith-based ideologies could lead to such violence. I mean, obviously, there's a massive geopolitical impact to that. That's not just using faith to brainwash people. But like I said, at that moment from 2001 until I turned 18 in 2010, my entire idea of my future was based on learning everything I could about terrorism, including the languages of these countries overseas where it was being hosted, and really going into counterterrorism and protecting the United States.
Yeah. Is there anything you could tell us about your service at all, or is that sort of as much as you can tell us?
No. So I joined the Air Force explicitly to become a linguist. I knew that the Defense Language Institute existed because my older brother had gone through it previously. Actually, I wanted to go into the Army, and then my parents had this big intervention and threatened to make me talk to him about going into the Air Force.
Okay.
And that alone was enough for me to go into the Air Force recruiter's office. And my initial language that I had chosen was Arabic and then Pashto, but they assigned me Farsi. So it actually took a few years of schooling and kind of angling my way to get into a Pashto class as well. And from then on, my missions were primarily focused on the war in Afghanistan, which is exactly what I had wanted to do. Unfortunately, I realized as a linguist in the Air Force, my chances of deploying to Afghanistan to see for myself the war and the people involved, because I was very much interested in the humanitarian aspect of the war at that time. And I just thought, as a woman, as a white woman, how can I get closer to this conflict so I can see what the world needs? Was I'm going to go with the Air Force. And they said, you're not going to deploy. So I got out of the Air Force and started seeking more private defense contracts. And so I had picked up that one that I was at the time of the felony as a Farsi linguist. But I was still very much in contact with recruiters trying to get a deployment to Bagram.
Yeah, yeah. And why wouldn't they allow linguists in the field? Is it just because of their concern that if you got captured that you'd be able to give away something, or?
No, absolutely not. We were of zero value in that regard. It was more about the education that they had put into us. It cost $2 million for a security clearance. And with satellites, we could do our job from a desk, which was a lot cheaper than having us go forward deploy.
Yeah, yeah. And I just recently watched the film about your experiences of being arrested. And I remembered that you'd mentioned, or at least the actress who was playing you mentioned, about you wanted to potentially sort of deploy with special forces. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think that my idea of a linguist, and they had corrected me in language school that what I had wanted to become was a debriefer, somebody who's talking to non-enemy combatants to get the full story of what's going on after like an operation, right? And I just wanted to talk to people. I wanted to understand where people were coming from and how this violence, how the United States kicking down doors in Afghanistan was only perpetuating this ideology that we were allegedly against in Afghanistan.
What were your ambitions then before the leak? You know, where did you imagine your career in the NSA would take you?
I was really ambitious and I was really naive. I wanted to get another 10 years under my belt and be that counterterrorism expert. I wanted to be in the Oval Office. I wanted to be that person telling the President of the United States, you know, so much of this extremism can be solved through early childhood development. It could be solved through infrastructure in these countries and not having an entire generation grow up with PTSD.
Yeah.
That was my goal, is to position myself into that. And without an Ivy League education, I thought I was going to build it one contract at a time, one deployment at a time, and have a resume that nobody could argue with.
Yeah. And did that feel realistic to you prior to the leak, or do you feel that you did need an Ivy League education to get to that point?
Honestly, it did feel realistic. I mean, where I was at watching the wars that I was watching, could I have used my GI Bill? Yes. Could I have gotten into an Ivy League school? Maybe, probably. But I was so obsessed with Afghanistan and Syria that I didn't want to go be a child again for 4 years in school. I wasn't going to connect to anybody else in my age range because I was so obsessed.
Yeah. How did working inside the world of intelligence shape your understanding of America's role in the world?
Honestly, where I was at, it was so low level and it was so compartmentalized. I was still with people who saw a mission that was good, that had clear objectives. Like when I worked with Afghanistan, we were just protecting American soldiers, right? We were not part of what people would call the deep state. What we were given in front of us was one clear objective, one clear task, and that's what we did. And I think that is something that there could be larger reflections on, how insidiously you can have a million people convinced that their one piece of the machine is good while the machine is doing bad things in the bigger picture.
And do you feel then that the machine is doing bad things in the bigger picture?
Yeah, I think that we severely fucked up with Afghanistan just because, you know, reading the Afghanistan papers, and I think even by 2012, when I was still in Persian Farsi intelligence school, reading Ahmed Rashid's Taliban, understanding that we've been at war with those people for 11 years by that point. And there were no clear-cut objectives as to what we were doing fighting them. We didn't actually know who they were because they weren't uniformed. And just understanding that they actually had very little to do with 9/11 itself. You know, the leader of the Taliban didn't even know that the Twin Towers existed until he saw them falling down on September 12th because they had to bring a TV to him.
Yeah.
And that was the big enemy that suddenly I was wearing a uniform to fight a war against. And it was like the disillusionment against that. And obviously post 2021, seeing how we left the country and seeing where the country is now, and then reading Donald Rumsfeld's memos that we're not there for nation building, then what did we do? Like, why did we prop up that government and then abandon it? It's just, yeah, I mean, it is so hard to understand how I was sold an idea of what we would be doing over there. And then honestly, the one thing we needed to do was just send food and medical supplies.
Yeah, yeah. What do you feel then you were sold that you were going to be doing in Afghanistan? Did you feel it was about nation building and making a better place, or was it something else?
Nation building, making it a better place, talking people off that ledge of that ideology, because what I had seen from studying the Taliban is that they weren't necessarily at war with the United States. Yeah, they would say ugly things, but their primary goal was within the four corners of Afghanistan. And if we had just left well enough alone and used, economic carrots to walk them back away from Sharia law, it would have happened. It would have taken very long, but at least walk them back from international terrorism. That would have been much more possible than blowing up half the country.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for that. So I'm going to move us into sort of the document you shared with The Intercept. So the document you shared with The Intercept, an NSA analysis on Russia cyber operations during the 2016 election, has now become part of the public record. What did you see in that report that made it feel significant enough to share?
I can't really talk about the contents, but what I did know is that we were living in Trump's America, and the document was identified as belonging to the NSA, and that it was top secret. And so I knew that we were kind of past the phase of critical thinking, and that with America's media literacy, they needed to see the brand and the source. And so that was my goal in sending the entire document to The Intercept, and not just kind of whispering it to a journalist the way that Congress does their little leaks.
Yeah.
Is that I just wanted the American people to see the text, you know, black letters on white paper. And I really wanted them to see all of the facts so that they could see what their media outlet was leaving out on purpose.
Yeah. And were you surprised that that document hadn't leaked before you shared it with The Intercept?
Yes. We were waiting one day at a time for that to hit the news.
Yeah. So you thought it somebody would put a whisper in Congress's ear, so to speak.
Honestly, that document was so clear cut that some experts have postulated to me that it was bait, that it was too good to be true, that it was something that they knew would leak and they were waiting for someone to leak even.
Yeah. And then on the day you printed the report, James Comey had just been fired as FBI director. So in that moment, did it kind of feel like a spontaneous act, or did you sense you were kind of crossing a line you couldn't come back from?
It is so hard to go back to that time because not necessarily the trauma of the arrest, but the fact that I did print the document and I did mail it out. And for 2 weeks, for 3 weeks, nothing happened. And so for me, every day moving forward from that, like I waited 7 days and on the eighth day I woke up and it wasn't a headline. And so I said, the only way I can move forward and continue coming into NSA as an employee is if I just forget this happened. And so I just forced myself to forget about all of those ideas, everything that I did on that day, in order to survive moving forward, because I was convinced it either never got delivered, it got lost in the mail, they saw it, they didn't take it seriously, that it really didn't happen. And so like, that was so strong. Cause I mean, I wasn't sleeping. My eyes were twitching. I was shaking all the time. And in order to get past that, I just pretended like that didn't happen.
So did you ever, with what you were feeling, did you ever think about using an internal whistleblower channel, or did they sort of feel closed off from the start, especially with this subject matter and at that time?
Yeah, so they felt closed off from the start. The fact that I had repeatedly asked HR at NSA to not stream Fox News on every available television within the building, that I had asked for less partisan media. And just the fact that seeing that in 2017, in my mind, I had thought that every relevant agency had seen it. I thought that Congress had seen it. I thought that everybody was in on it and they were just laughing at the American people.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think then that they were literally just trying to sort of brush it under the rug, largely because it was sort of embarrassing to Trump or something?
I just thought they were trying to go along with the new king. And if I had known that most of the government hadn't seen it, even though a million of us with clearances had seen it, you know, I would have taken it to Bernie Sanders myself. Right. I would have gotten a car and driven it to Bernie Sanders. And at least I would have done my 4 years in prison as the girl who committed espionage with Congress. Right. Like,
yeah.
That would have been much easier. But when you think the entire government's in on it, then you do something stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So many of our listeners are, well, as we recently found out, many of our listeners are former intelligence officials, and they may well be kind of critical of your decision to leak information. So what would you say to them and others in government service about that decision and why you made it?
I was critical of leakers too. Because of Snowden, we had to go through extra turnstiles and had our lunchboxes looked through. Nobody wants to be the guy at the office that makes everybody else's job inconvenient. Right? The Jack Teixeira leaks onto Discord, those were widespread and damaging to Ukraine, right? It's not like you can be like, all leaks good, all leaks bad. I think that there's incredible discretion that can be used. And I would just ask for them to see, like, at the time of the leak, I 100% believe that document was obsolete. And I 100% believe that that document was kept from relevant government agencies, even though it was obsolete, because they wanted to appease the current administration. And I would have them look more critically at the way we prosecute leaks, and that the government has zero burden of proof in a court to show that you could leak anything. You could leak an email. You could leak your high side password and get hit with the same Espionage Act. And when you're sitting in the courtroom and the government doesn't have to prove that you caused damage to national security, we have an unjust law.
Yeah. What could be, so we talked a moment ago about some internal whistleblower channels. What could be improved with that to prevent people maybe from leaking things when they feel compelled to?
Yes. So I am a spokesperson for whistleblowerAid.org. Whistlebloweraid.org. That's so hard to say right now.
That's right.
They are not asking for your information. They don't want to know your leak. If you're thinking about leaking, you can send them a encrypted message, and they will team you up with a lawyer, a pro bono lawyer, who will advise you on how to leak in a protected way. Again, they will never ask you for the information you have, how you have it, what agency you're from. You will be assigned a lawyer who will walk you through and how to protect you. And all of that is free. And I think that moving forward, that is something that needs to be done. Especially like, and like I said, they want whistleblowers, right? Fraud, waste, abuse type situations. And so if you have just like a general leak or something like that, you will also have a lawyer telling you, you will not be protected by law. Right? The American people will not have your back. You will be charged in this district, right? If I had known I would be charged in the Southern District of Georgia or charged at all like that, I mean, no way, right? And so they'll tell you, like, this is the judge you're going to get. This is who they're trying to please. And you will get like a play-by-play of what your future will look like or how to do it safely. And so I'm not saying don't do it, but I'm also saying that there is an infrastructure out there that will help you for free.
Yeah. And is there anything like government agencies could be doing better to help sort of, you know, if there is a situation where somebody's in your shoes that you could speak to somebody confidentially within the organization? It sounds a bit ridiculous, but is there something that government agencies could do to sort of... not police themselves better, but sort of be more transparent in their actions and stuff?
Absolutely not. These agencies are rotten to the core, and they have us do these annual PowerPoints about the insider threat. And it covers somebody like selling nuclear secrets to North Korea. And somebody like, I made the PowerPoint. I am now on that briefing of somebody who did it ideologically. There is no internal infrastructure if you feel like the government is hiding something from the American people. Like, imagine you find out who actually shot JFK, and then you're going to go to your HR office and be like, hey, I think the American people should know this. Like, yeah. You're going to be in a cell in the basement before you know it. Like, there is no way to reason with these agencies. You either feel so strongly that you get out, or you work with a lawyer to get the information out.
So looking back at your experiences, do you wish the public conversation had focused more on what the document revealed rather than who revealed it, being you?
Yes, absolutely. And I do believe that that was on purpose by The Intercept. They had zero intention of publishing that information. They worked with the feds to find out who I was, and they did not publish the document until the DA for the Southern District of Georgia wanted to have a press conference on revealing my identity that Tuesday of my arraignment. And they published it, I think, maybe 43 minutes before that press conference, because they knew my name would hit the headlines and people would be Googling it and they would be looking for the document and they would miraculously have it up because they believed or whatever supported they had a martyr on their hands. And so from day one of this whole ordeal, this has only been about who I am. It has never been about the document. And that was completely on The Intercept's, you know, that's their fault. If they didn't want to publish that information, they should have burned the document and moved on. Instead, they chose, Matthew Cole of The Intercept chose to make this about who I was.
Why do you think that was?
Because he's messy, because he's scandalous, because he's a small man. I mean, I have nothing nice to say about him. This was all because of him. I did what I did. I take responsibility for what I did. I was willing to go down for that document. But I was willing for that. I wanted that document to be published to the American people. I wanted people to see the importance of that information and then have the authorities looking for me.
Yeah, yeah. Because The Intercept's interesting case study because they are the paper who obviously collaborated with Snowden via Glenn Greenwald. But I have noticed Glenn Greenwald in particular went very Trumpy himself. And I wondered whether internally the ideology of the paper itself had shifted by the time you leaked that information.
Honestly, because so many of the stories that they were covering, like Yemen and Syria, and they were acting like actual military correspondents, you know, and they were very critical of both Obama and the incoming Trump administration. It just felt like people who were cynical about the deep state itself and not necessarily Trumpy or Democrat. I think that Glenn just thinks of himself as a libertarian, which is Republican light. But like I said, he wasn't even there at the time. He never wanted to publish that document. And for whatever reason, that's fine. He doesn't think I'm very intelligent. That's fine. He is not the one that sent it to the NSA. He is not the one that tried to find out who I was.
No, fair enough, fair enough. The Intercept's handling of your document exposed you. So what lessons should journalists and editors take from that failure?
Find out who the rats are in your institution and get them out. Eventually, Laura Poitras did resign from The Intercept over the handling of my document. She felt like something wrong had been done, and The Intercept refuses to publicly acknowledge that. They refuse to say who it was and why it happened. When I have the correspondence, right? We have the court evidence of how I was caught. Unfortunately, I'm not the only source that they had caught. It is by design. They screwed over Terry Albury and Daniel Hale as well, because they like to do that so they have somebody to prop up against the system.
And how do you see the relationship between whistleblowers and the press today? Has that trust eroded since your case?
I mean, I think it has. And one of the messages of my memoir right now is to show that if you really do believe in what you're getting out into the public, you've got to be ready for these next 4 or 5 years of prison. I went through it. Terry Albury went through it. Daniel Hale went through it. Obviously, we are required to say we would never recommit that crime again. And honestly, I don't think I would, just given that it was made about me and not what I thought the American people needed to know. I should have worked with my congressman or picked a congressman to work with on that. I should have had more faith in my elected representatives. But at the same time, you know, if you're going to do something, find a journalist you trust, find a lawyer you trust, but also look at my memoir. Like, I survived, I made it through, and you can too.
Mm. You watched parts of the media obviously turn you into a symbol or a caricature. What did that teach you about how information and identity are weaponized in American politics?
I learned that anything you say or do on social media will be pulled out of context. Things like I was doing a yoga competition with my friend to hold like the longest plank possible. And I laughingly, like at minute 22, said like, oh, I hate everything. And that's what the media decided to pull, even though that was done almost a year before. Actually, that was done in 2015.
Yeah.
You know, a year before all of this had happened. They decided to show that as to why I did what I did. But they didn't want people on the right to be sympathetic to me. So there were like no pictures of me with my AR-15, right? They were very selective in how they portrayed me in the media. And I mean, obviously what the prosecution said about me, I mean, that was probably more traumatic than anything. And the fact that none of the journalists in the room were willing to pick up on the fact that the prosecutor could say things like, she was clearly sympathetic to the Taliban.
Yeah, yeah. What was that about?
Yeah, so my defense team was not allowed to get up and say, Your Honor, she is not, and we can prove it, because your character and intent are not relevant when you are charged with espionage. And so even though the prosecution could say it and not be checked by the judge, we were not allowed to rebut it. And that was the half of the story that the journalists were not catching. Nobody wanted to write in the New York Times, oh, by the way, the judge silenced the defense attorney every time he stood up to speak, you know, or threatened him with contempt because he pointed out the defendant's demographics and why she would not make a good candidate for international terrorism, stuff like that. Because they had found my journals and they had found my notes about feeding children in Afghanistan, about neurology, about they found my copy of Taliban by Ahmed Rashid, that it was marked up and had notes in it. And that, you know, I was studying a way to actually fix this generation of Afghans so that their best government option wasn't the Taliban and that they all didn't have PTSD. And then they took one line, but my father, at a very early age, you know, the satanic verses controversy happened a year before I was born, and my father was obsessed with it. He wanted to understand how one book could get a death sentence. And so he had one of the original copies of the book, and he would always show it to me, and he would always tap it and be like, you know, people are dying because of this book. And I just remember, until I could actually read like actual chapters, I always read the very first page of the book. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's just the two main characters falling out of the sky. And that's what I read over and over again as a child until I could understand the book. And in a way, you know, idolizing Salman Rushdie, I wanted a fatwa. So I wanted to write a response based on, you know, mid-20-teen knowledge of the geopolitical state of terrorism in the world with the Taliban, with the rise of ISIS, you know, write a sequel to the Satanic Verses. And so I had the thesis of the book written in a diary somewhere, and that's what they quoted to make it seem like I was in support of terrorism when I really just wanted to impress my favorite author. And we weren't allowed to make that argument in court, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, thank you very much for sharing that. It's very interesting. Do you still plan to write that book one day?
I mean, since I pretty much did get a fatwa from one sentence, I might let that book stay unwritten.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough, fair enough. Just back to the leak in the press for a moment. If obviously you could do the leak again, would you still choose to send it to the press, or would you do it differently?
after everything I've gone through, I mean, mostly just because I hurt my family so badly, I have to say I would never commit that crime over. That was a mistake. That did not handle the information properly. And I did betray an agreement that I had signed with the United States of America. However, like if I'm still going to prison, if I'm going down for this, like I said, I would have hand delivered it to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Let's take a break and be right back with more. You write that the Espionage Act isn't really about espionage, it's about control. So what makes that law so dangerous in your view?
Study the history. When it was first drafted, it wasn't drafted at the start of World War One. It was, well, drafted is a funny word to say, but it was signed into law after the first draft for World War One. And it was not about just protecting locations of troops and ships and stuff like that. It was about making sure people could not impede with the first registration of men for the draft. And that's how it was used primarily. And so throughout the next 100 years or so, it's been used primarily against people who bring the information forward to the press, and less for actual people who commit espionage.
We've kind of touched upon this already, but do you think your prosecution has changed anything inside the intelligence community, or do those cultural blind spots still exist?
I think that they still exist. I mean, I know that there's quite a few people now that are, you know, giggling because I'm on the brief as an insider threat. I can't even imagine what it felt like actually making it through the Trump presidency the first time around as a federal employee or a subcontractor. I only made it like 3 months before I kind of snapped. I couldn't take it anymore. I can't imagine anybody still doing it now. Anybody not getting paid to do it now. I mean, how much do you hate yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any friends who've been subjected to those DOGE cuts or anything like that?
You know, anybody that would has been somebody that hasn't been allowed to talk to me since 2017.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough. How do you think the US should balance secrecy with the public's right to know?
I don't like cops. But I think that there are times when there is a police investigation and something is pending, that information is not out in public. But once there's a conviction, once we know, like, let's just say like a serial killer or something like that, once they are caught and put away and there's no appeal in the court, everything about that case should be transparent. And that's kind of just, you know, that's how I feel about things much larger. So if a war is resolved, we should know everything about World War II. We should know where all those Nazis went into our fucking space program, right? We should know where they went. We should know about Paperclip. Same thing with Vietnam. Same thing with the MLK murder. We should know everything. Once it's resolved, we should have all of that information. Same thing with 9/11. You know, the 9/11 commissioner's report barely scratches the surface. And the fact that any of that would be held, like the idea, you can't, if you don't have secrets, people can't be suspicious of you. So as long as there's not something pending that is sensitive, I think that the average person, even your most cynical listener, could appreciate that. It should immediately be published for public consumption. And that way you don't have all these conspiracy theories.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think there is a habit to overclassify things then and just hold on to things for the sake of it?
Oh, absolutely. I can't remember who published a book on it, but they basically said that in the evolution of like the actual Classification Act, when we invented classification levels, I think we produce like 2 billion classified documents a year now.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because you have to have like classification officers, you have to have spaces for it, you have to have data servers for it. All of that has to be super encrypted. I mean, like if you want to complain about AI wasting water, you should talk about these terabytes of classified irrelevant information that our government has to store for however many years an unelected bureaucrat decided it needs to be stored for.
Mm-hmm. Some people obviously compare you with other whistleblowers and leakers like Edward Snowden. How do you feel about those comparisons?
You know, I like Ed a lot. I think that we do have a lot in common. He was obviously more into like the tech side of it, like trying to get the information out digitally. You know, and I've never, like, we know why he's stuck in Russia. Like, we know how that happened, right? I don't necessarily mind it, you know? I mean, I prefer to stand in the company of people like Daniel Hale and Terry Aubrey because we did what we did and then we faced the consequences and we got through it. Like, I think surviving the public humiliation of being tried and convicted in this country is not something that, you know, anybody wants to do, but that millions of Americans go through anyway. And the fact that we did it and we made it through, you know, I would prefer to be, I wish their names were a lot more publicly highlighted because what they did was really important.
And obviously you've spoken with figures like Daniel Ellsberg and Thomas Drake. What did those conversations sort of teach you about the cost of conscience?
I mean, I always tear up because the very last time I spoke to Daniel Ellsberg before he passed, I mean, it was like really close before that. And, you know, there was like this progression. At first, he said I wasn't a whistleblower. I was just a leaker. And then over the years, he kind of came around. And, you know, the last thing he ever said to me was that he was proud of me and that if he could do anything over again, he wouldn't have waited. He said that you saw something and within a week you did something, and that's what he wished that he had done. And I don't, like, I mean, I put in my memoir because that's how it, like, I know we don't really talk about Harry Potter anymore because J.K. Rowling is a but like I grew up feeling like Harry Potter, like waiting for someone to come around and tell me I was special. And that was, you know, Dan Ellsberg. He said that. He was the first. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people say it, but like coming from him, saying that he wished that he had done what I had done, you know, when he's Daniel Ellsberg, I mean, it's just, I can't, I'm never, no one can ever take that moment away from me.
Thank you for sharing that. You said that you believed Americans are being lied to. When you look at the US today with disinformation and distrust still rampant, do you feel anything's changed?
Oh, I mean, we are absolutely being lied to. And I mean, it's just, we've always been lied to. We can go back 100 years of white voters losing their money and their food and their public spaces because they've been sold the lie of racism, that they can't possibly share it with anybody who doesn't look like them, or God forbid they share it with Black Americans. And we're seeing that right now. Like, people will not get their SNAP benefits in November. And they're being sold this lie that they're going to defend a pedophile and then lose the food that they want on the table for Thanksgiving. And that the idea that, you know, welfare is for lazy people when more white people are in welfare than anybody else. It's just, we are being lied to, and not even in like this, like, you know, super sexy counterterrorism, top secret espionage, deep state type of way. Americans are just being lied to fundamentally on who is worth more as a human being and who isn't. And who deserves food, shelter, clean water, clean air, and healthcare, and who doesn't? And I mean, part of that lie stems from what they think that they have earned or what they've deserved. you know, the lie of privilege. I think that these lies go so deep into our identity, and they're even entrenched within our religious institutions as well, the Christian nationalism. I think that the biggest lesson for me with this experience is to stop looking outside our borders for some foreign threat, and that our homegrown ideology of white supremacy is what's going to cause this country to collapse. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now.
There's a whole kind of alt-right information ecosystem on YouTube, etc. And some of our other podcasts in our space sometimes fall into that category because they're kind of, I don't know, I feel like there's lots of stuff about sort of deep state and conspiracy theories that are thrown around that I feel are kind of a distraction from more grounded issues like you're discussing here about sort of social welfare and things like that. Because I'm in the UK, we're very lucky at this time to have a national health service, to have certain social benefits should things go wrong. Obviously, slowly that's unfortunately changing. I don't know where the question is going now, but do you feel things like the deep state and conspiracy theories and other things are kind of a bit of a distraction from those kind of more tangible issues? Yeah, there's a question in that.
I definitely think it is. I think that this concept that the government has then been created to undermine what they think they deserve is a huge part of it. Mm. I, however, don't think that tech has necessarily made it any worse. I mean, they didn't need YouTube to convince millions of white Americans that they could own people from Africa. They didn't need technology for that. This has been something that is very unique to the original sin of the United States, and that the digital, I guess, environment now is just another place for it to take part.
I find it's a bit more kind of covert too, because there's a lot of podcasts out there that are very alt-right but very light, and people watching them just don't realize some of the kind of ideology underneath all of it. I mean, I'll point at Joe Rogan. He has a lot of people on his show that are very questionable in my opinion, and a lot of people kind of consume that content but don't sort of realize they're kind of in a way ending up on this sort of alt-right mindset. I've had many friends who've gone down a rabbit hole and unfortunately not come out of it a good way. And I don't know sort of what you feel about those kind of things.
Honestly, I think before, probably about 2023 is when I stopped, but I used to enjoy Joe Rogan. Obviously, he would have very far right leaning people on there and I would just be like, no. But then he had, I am not going to try to pronounce his name. I don't want to disrespect him, but it Reed Cobalt Red. And he had a 4-hour podcast with the author of Cobalt Red at a time when he wasn't getting a lot of mainstream attention. And the fact that Joe has had prison abolitionists on his show before, and that he's been very progressive, and he used to just have like no-name comedians and like 7 to 10 hours of UFC content per week. And I like that sport, right? It used to be that. And then over the years, I was like, man, I just really wish that he didn't have these crazy, like, far-right people on there. I wish he didn't make Tulsi Gabbard sound so sane. I think for me, one of the biggest breaks was, like, the litter boxes in the schools. He didn't push back on that. I stopped listening probably very shortly after that. You know, it's like, you can have those people, but you also need to have somebody come on the next week and be like, actually, those things are false and this is why. You know, because he used to be a little more progressive. He used to really talk about the war on drugs and, you know, where it started in the United States and what it was for. And I'm so disappointed in him following the money and the sponsorships and the circle jerk that you said, that far right conspiracy theory circle is generating so much revenue online, and because the clicks go around and the eyeballs are on it. And I really wish that he would more like stand up for the things that he used to believe in. And every now and then you do see the clips where he's pushing back. He's starting to turn against ICE. He's starting to be like, actually, this is not like when I had RFK on 7 times last year and made everybody listen to that voice for 3 hours at a time. This actually wasn't what I envisioned, right? Like, I think that there would be so much more revenue and so much just more like saving his soul if he would just come back to why he started his show all those years ago. But unfortunately, there's way too much positive feedback in these right-wing pockets of the internet where, like, I mean, I've lost a lot of respect for him because the people he's now catering to, I mean, they're domestic terrorists. They're Nazis. They're literal not like people are like, don't be so hyperbolic. But it's like, I'm sorry, they have actual fucking swastikas and double lightning bolts.
Yeah, you can't get more Nazi than that.
I don't know what you want me to call them. You know, it's so disappointing. You know, and he could change that. He could change all of that by the guests that are selected for his show. He could change that by growing a backbone again.
Yeah. Let's take a break and be right back with more. You describe the prison system as a system where cruelty is the point. So what did those years teach you about America, about the America that you didn't know before?
You know, it's crazy, but like 2 weeks before that, I had watched 13th on Netflix and had been kind of cued into Jim Crow 2.0 and understanding that we don't have to have enslaved people in fields to profit off of the ownership of human bodies, and that the industrialization of our prison system is exactly that. If I had been allowed one more year of research, I would have found out about Harry Anslinger and the start of the war on drugs and how the substances that we define as being illegal are tied to an ethnic ID or ethnic identity in this country to fill jail cells around the country. They don't even have to get a federal, well, they're going to get a federal conviction, but the federal prison system isn't where so much of the money is. It's all in those pre-trial county jails getting federal contracts. And, you know, the prison population has increased exponentially in the last 25, 30 years alone. And the revenue, you would think like, oh my gosh, we have so many people incarcerated. It's $32,000 per year of taxpayer money to house these individuals. But that money's then just being paid to the feds. So the feds are paying the feds to prosecute human beings. It is the biggest money laundering scheme, you know, probably not as big as the Pentagon, but it's just as big. And the people that I've been incarcerated with, some of them should never see the light of day again. You know, it's very hard being a prison abolitionist, when I have personally had to share a cell with a child molester, right? It is very hard to argue for that knowing the worst of the worst. But at the same time, I don't know how to reform a system that was an extension of slavery. I don't know how to do that. It's kind of like the death penalty. The number of Black men in the United States that have been wrongfully executed, and the fact that we have no chance of reversing sort of the racial profiling of who's deemed competent to stand trial or who is deemed an adult in this country, who can stand trial as an adult or who gets the juvenile system. It's like, if you're not going to do it right, don't do it at all, and we'll just have street justice. Like, I don't know what else to say at that point.
And about your sort of experiences in prison, how did you preserve your sense of self through confinement and then obviously public vilification?
Yeah. It was so, and there's a reason why to this day I don't watch anything about me. I don't read anything about me. I'm not going to go listen to this interview to see how you edited it or whatever. Anytime I see something about me, I physically start shaking very bad. My teeth start chattering because I would get out of court. I would be shackled for a 40-minute drive, come back to my jail cell, want to wash myself off. And then the local news would come on and it was a ritual. People were, you know, institutionalized. They had to watch the local news. And that was when the TV anchors would repeat verbatim every unfounded accusation the prosecution made about me. And I had to live in a room with people who were media illiterate who would hear that and be like, oh my gosh, I didn't know you were Russian. You were in the Russian military. Like, you're a spy. Like, you know, stuff like, you tried to kill Donald Trump. And I'm just like, no, that's not what they're saying. Like, You know what I mean? It was bad enough hearing it from the prosecution, but then the terrible game of telephone that is the American media and then the media illiteracy of the people of the United States was so physically traumatic. The only thing that kept me going was knowing that my mother and people around her were creating a following on Twitter and were creating a social movement to support me. And the fact that I got like 20 letters a day, I had any book I wanted, people started seeing that. The people that would just send the most beautiful like greeting cards, which sounds so dumb, but when you're in a place that you're not even allowed toilet paper, and I'm getting like these origami cards, I'm getting these like shiny cards with glitter and stuff like that. And people are like, oh, like people care about you. And it was, and then I was getting resources. People were pressuring the jail to give us fresh food. So I earned fresh fruit for the entire jail of 75 people. And that was the first fresh fruit some of those people had had in years.
That's insane. And well done for doing that.
Yeah. And so people started to understand that I wasn't just trying to get ahead for me, that I wanted better for everybody around me. And that's really what I kind of positioned my time as an incarcerated person as.
Mm. And you mentioned you found purpose of teaching fitness and yoga inside. So why did physical strength become a kind of key part of the emotional survival for you?
Because well before I was ever locked up, I had several eating disorders and at one point had starved myself down to 11% body fat, which is critically low for a female to be at. And, you know, my recovery from that was going into CrossFit. And CrossFit doesn't care what your body weight is. CrossFit doesn't care about your body dysmorphia. It just like, what can you do that day? It was so competitive and intense. And so when I was locked up, the hardest thing for me was, oh, I can't do CrossFit. Like the one thing that kept me from being bulimic was the very first thing that I had lost. And so for me, I had shaped every single day about how do I do CrossFit in a 6x6 cell? How do I make that happen? And that was, I mean, that was why I was not involved in my own defense. That is why I refused meetings with my attorneys because it interfered with the time I would spend desperately trying to work out. And then in prison, my one goal was to take over the recreation department and not just like, oh, I was getting paid 12 cents an hour to teach a fitness circuit class or to teach a spin class. It was people would see me and know I had access to that space whenever I wanted it. All I had to say was, I'm going to work. And the compound officer would let me go to that recreation department. I was the first one there. I had access to the equipment. Not because like I'm like, you know, main character energy. It was because if I do not work out enough today, I am not eating today. Therefore, I'm not surviving today. And that's the only thing I focused on for 4 years.
Thank you for sharing that. After your release, what has rebuilding a life and an identity looked like for you?
CrossFit.
Yeah, fair enough.
I'm in a cult. Like, y'all can call me stupid. It has been, I mean, the moment I got off, I got out of the halfway house and got to come home on an ankle monitor was, if I can't go past my house for 200 feet, how do I run? You know, so I started running circles around the yard. My parents bought me an indoor bike, a stationary bike. So I started doing my own spin classes. Someone bought a rig and a squat rack for me and some barbells. So I built a gym at my house. And my mom got me a job as a CrossFit coach because I had to have a job once I got out of the halfway house. Like, you're just required. And I applied everywhere in town. I mean, I still say it today. I could apply at Walmart and not get a call back. I cannot work in this country. And so she put on Facebook, "Hi, my daughter's a yoga, CrossFit coach, yoga, fitness, blah, blah, blah." And my third grade music teacher saw that on Facebook. And she was like, "Hey, my daughter owns a gym and they need a coach." Yeah. So the moment I had that ankle monitor cut off, I met with my probation officer. I still wasn't even authorized to drive. And my dad took me to the gym and I met my boss. And from that day forth, I have been in that gym 6 days a week. And it's been 4 years now. I'm the head coach. And that's been my entire identity. I got into dog rescue and since then have used my GI Bill to get into a veterinary technology program at my local university. And so if I'm not in school and I'm not home with my dogs, I'm at that gym with my clients. And that's what my entire life, that's what my entire hustle is about right now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, good for you for sort of being able to get into that. So that's brilliant. And you mentioned a bit about, obviously, the animal care. Do you want to talk a bit more about that? Because that's obviously very important to you.
Yeah, actually, I'm surprised she or he hasn't started crying. Yesterday, my boyfriend's terrible. He just sends me pictures of bloodied up cats.
Okay.
And then the message, he waits like 5 minutes and then sends the actual message. And it's like, he said a buzzard was eating this kitten alive on the side of the highway. And I was just like, that's great. I can't really afford this right now, but let me take it to school. The director of my program gave him some medical care. We are fostering him for right now because I cannot afford another cat in my life. We already have 3 rescues. But that's what we do. We find animals on the side of the road and, you know, get them to medical care as soon as possible, and we figure out the rest later. One of my other foster dogs just, you know, the family just committed to her, so she's staying in her forever home. We have 2 foster dogs right now. I'm getting a third one back tonight, so we usually stay around 8 to 10 dogs. You know, it's not always happy. I found some dogs get hit by cars before, so, you know, out of my own pocket, I'm the one that takes them in. We make the final call that we can't save them. And I'm the one holding the dog when it passes. Like, that's what rescue is. My goal in life is to make sure that every animal finds the best possible resolution for its life. We have 10 acres. Hopefully someday with some grants or, you know, maybe after we survive this fascist takeover of America, I would like to have a dog sanctuary for dogs that aren't suitable for homes. Because in my life, I bought a dog. I thought she would be perfect because I bought her and because she had been vetted. And she turned out extremely aggressive. And so we've built our life around accommodating her. And so I know not every family's going to have those types of resources and that type of dedication to work with a dog like that. And so that's part of what I want my rescue efforts to go towards. And then also just working in the medical field and working in animal control, that's what I really hope this degree is going to put me in a position to make this my life's work.
Yeah, yeah. I hope that works out for you. That sounds very good. Just wrapping up then. So you've written about sort of forgiveness towards the government, the media, and yourself. How do you practice that now?
I feel like I have adequately remedied my reputation. You can look up anywhere where I am telling you what I did and why I did it. I feel like I have addressed every degrading lie that the prosecution has levied against me. And, you know, forgiveness and revenge are so close together. I can do both just by living a better life. And, you know, I don't need a lot of validation. I don't really like it when people tell me I'm a hero. I don't feel like a hero. I don't even really feel like a whistleblower. I just feel like a scandalous leaker, right? But I know that there's not going to be a movie about that prosecutor showing that she saved her country, right? Like, I know that in the end, whether you think I'm an idiot or not, that the public record that I've left behind is not somebody who has damaged national security for the United States. I am not somebody that betrayed my country. You know, I can't speak to why it happened, but there are institutions and agencies that have said that I left them in a better place because of my leak. There's an entire documentary about it. And so I know that I've made it through this, and I don't need to hold anything against anybody because I'm living better despite what I've been through.
Yeah. And then if a young analyst felt the same moral tension you once did, what would you tell them before they act?
Whistlebloweraid.org. Do not go to The Intercept. Honestly, don't go to any corporate-owned media. Like, really research, like, all of these places. And honestly, really think about it. Is this information going to change something right now? Or can I go and do something in my local government that's going to improve somebody's quality of life? I definitely think that we are where we are. I fell victim to it, but we are where we are because we let the president of the United States make decisions. We gave them the power to impact our day-to-day life. And that is not how the United States was structured to be. It was that your local government, your city, your county, and your state government should be the first and only thing that impacts your life. And most people can't even name their own mayor. Most people don't know what laws that are up for vote in their county or state in a few weeks when November starts. But they know what the president's doing. And I do feel like the media and the Republican Party and, you know, corporate Democrats have been pushing for this for 50 years now since Reagan to consolidate power to where we are all waiting for one person in that Oval Office to determine if we get welfare or healthcare when it should have been, why can't we have a push against federalism? You know, maybe the anti-federalists were onto something. Definitely a push for more individual states to take charge of the quality of life within that state's border and say, we don't need a president. We don't need a federal government, and have more states in this country decide to not send their taxes to a federal government that's going to send them to other states or to put them into a gilded ballroom. You know, we need to start state first, Texas first, California first. These states need to start acting on their own and show the government that that's how this country was designed.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish today? Something I might have missed that's important to you?
No, I mean, people just need to continue to think critically. I mean, this is going to be obviously a very the needle point of your audience, you know, are already individuals that are paying attention to the rest of the world and know the cycles of dictatorship and know what we're falling into.
Well, Reality Winner, thank you so much for your time today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your book?
So I am on Instagram as Reazlepuff, R-E-A-Z-L-E-P-U-F-F. But mostly those are just going to be dog videos and stuff like that.
That's cool.
But there is a link to my book there. My book is published through Spiegel and Growl if you want to buy directly from publisher, or wait a while and get it used on Thrift Books. That's fine as well. Get it bootlegged. Please don't get it from Amazon. And, you know, you don't need to know anything else about me unless you're interested in what my dogs are doing. You know, there's going to be a massive boycott and a general strike November 25th through December 2nd. Don't do a single thing on Black Friday. You know, go into a Victorian era depression and lay in bed the entire day, and feed somebody else on Thanksgiving. That's the most important thing I can tell any American that's listening to this right now, because we've got to find a way to shut this down and to stop it.
Mm. Well, thank you again for your time on the show today. It's been really great to meet you and chat with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This has been really nice.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.